Everyone, the Labor, Industry, and Veterans and Military Affairs Finance and Policy Committee will come to order. I would like to announce that this meeting will take place in accordance with House Rule 10.01. This meeting may be viewed on the Public Information TV, which is available on the House website. As is custom with this committee, please rise for the Pledge of Allegiance. Pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Before we get started, Ms. Doyle, will you please take the roll?
Chair Eklund.
Present.
Vice Chair Zhang, excused. Representative Detmer. Representative McDonald.
I am here.
Representative Berg.
Present.
Representative Bliss.
Present.
Representative Edelson.
Present.
Representative Frederick.
Present.
Representative Greenman.
Present.
Representative Nelson.
Present.
Representative Poston.
Present.
Representative Raleigh.
Raleigh, present.
Representative Sundin.
Present.
We do have a quorum.
Thank you, Ms. Doyle. Next on the agenda is approval of the minutes from the February 17th, 2021 meeting. Every member should have received a copy of today's minutes in their inbox. Seeking a motion of approval for the minutes, Representative Edelson, have you had a chance to review the minutes?
Yes, Chair, and I'll move the minutes.
Representative Edelson moves the minutes from the February 17th, 2021 meeting. Any comments or corrections? Seeing none, all those in favor of the adoption of the minutes say aye.
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 Opposed say nay. The minutes are adopted. Members, we have a large agenda today. Excuse me. We have a large agenda today, and I intend to complete the agenda on time. I also intend to give every member of the public who signed up to testify their opportunity to testify. Members, please keep comments brief and on topic within the jurisdiction of the committee for both bills today. First up, House File 831 from Representative Long. I will move that House File 831 be referred to the Climate and Energy Finance and Policy Committee. Welcome, Chair Long, and please proceed with explaining your bill.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the committee taking this bill up today. House File 831 would improve our building codes for new commercial buildings. We had an exhaustive process with a task force that Governor Walz convened over the past couple of years with a broad number of stakeholders that my testifiers will speak to come up with the draft that we have today. But the bill is pretty straightforward. It would update our building energy efficiency codes for new commercial buildings every 3 years from now until 2036, with the goal of reaching net zero energy in 2036 for the new building construction for commercial buildings. And this would help us meet our state's greenhouse gas goals, which we're currently falling well short of. Buildings are 40% of the energy usage in our state, and even more in some communities. This bill had the support of a broad number of cities who have local greenhouse gas goals that they're really not able to achieve because of the difficulty of getting their hands around energy efficiency for buildings. And I'll be brief and stop there, and would love to have us hear from our testifiers.
Thank you, Chair Long. First testifier is Scott D. McClellan, Minnesota Department of Labor and Industry. Mr. McClellan, please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Scott McClellan. I'm the state building official and director of the Construction Codes and Licensing Division for the Department of Labor and Industry. I want to thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of House File 831. The bill before you today is the result of a recommendation or a series of recommendations from a building efficiency work group that was convened by the Departments of Commerce and Labor and Industry in 2019 and 2020. In addition to the work group recommendation, this legislation is also part of the governor's 2021 budget proposals to address climate change, specifically to create more resilient communities. Representative Long's bill takes a statewide approach to energy code improvements so as to ensure that all new commercial and large multifamily buildings that are constructed in the state, beginning in the year 2022, are designed to become progressively more energy efficient until newly constructed buildings become net zero users of energy by the year 2036 and beyond. So this statewide approach addresses concerns by work group members that any new energy regulations maintain uniformity, promote regulatory certainty, minimize complexity. And this approach also takes into account the goal of a coalition of a dozen or so municipalities that approach the department and others wanting to accelerate adoption of energy code requirements to achieve net zero energy by the year 2036. So this legislation aligns with the agency's existing statutory responsibility to comply with the U.S. Department of Energy's mandate that all states adopt new efficient commercial energy codes every 3 years. And as such, the department is currently in the early stages of reviewing the latest commercial energy code, ASHRAE 90.1, for adoption in the year 2022. So this action addresses our current statutory responsibility while satisfying the first step in the recommendations of the report from the work group. But because adoption of the ASHRAE standard alone every 3 years will likely be insufficient to achieve net zero by the year 2036, subsequent code adoptions would need to include an adjusted minimum percent efficiency to meet that goal. Therefore, the legislation before you today is needed to ensure that each future edition of the Commercial Energy Code adopted by Minnesota incorporate a minimum of 8% efficiency every 3 years. So this effort will be assisted by and is complementary to actually technologies already leveraged in two existing Minnesota programs, one being the B3 benchmarking, which tracks energy use, costs, and carbon for most public buildings, and the 2030 Sustainable Building Program, an energy standard enacted by the legislature that established similar progressive energy goals for all state bonded projects. In closing, improving energy efficiency in all new commercial and multifamily construction means better buildings, lower emissions, and a healthier Minnesota. And the Department of Labor and Industry is pleased to support House File 831. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. McClellan, and please stick around if there's any questions. Next testifier is Andy Snope from the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers. Mr. Snope, please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Good afternoon, Chair Eklund and committee members. Thank you for allowing me time to testify today on behalf of House File 831. My name is Andy Snope. I am the legislative director for the local 292 IBEW. We represent roughly 5,000 electrical workers who work throughout the state of Minnesota. IBEW Local 292 supports House File 831. This legislation provides for an accelerated adoption of the latest recommended standards for a statewide energy code for commercial buildings. Building energy efficiency is what our members and the contractors we work for do. We perform work that helps buildings perform better. Electrification, lighting and load control, building automation, building energy management, process control, and HVAC controls are all tasks that our members perform. We are trained to do these tasks, and we continually receive training to update our skills to meet the latest codes and standards. In 2019, we participated in the work group that was structured through the Department of Labor and Industry and the Department of Commerce. After 18 months of work with stakeholders, recommendations were published and distributed. This legislation is a result of these recommendations to create a process in which adoption of energy codes remain a statewide implementation and preserving the established regulatory conformity of the energy codes. This creates a statewide uniformity predictability that we support. and it also expedites the adoption of the process in which we support for new energy legislation. Thank you very much for allowing me to speak, and I'm available for any questions after this.
Thank you, Mr. Snow. Next up is Richard Graves. Mr. Graves, please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Eklund and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of the bill before you. My name is Richard Graves, and I'm the director of the Center for Sustainable Building Research at the University of Minnesota. At the center, we manage the B3 and SB 2030 programs for the state of Minnesota, which applies to all state-funded construction. The B3 guidelines include the Sustainable Buildings 2030 Energy and Carbon Standard that is scheduled to reach net zero energy carbon buildings by 2030. A net zero energy building is one that has integrated energy efficiency cost effectively and then selected energy sources that are renewable. I was honored to serve as the technical advisor to the Building Efficiency Workgroup formed by the Departments of Commerce and Labor and Industry in 2019 and early 2020. The departments and staff should be commended for their work with stakeholders to achieve consensus on the recommendations. The working group recommended to have the new model energy code follow a similar path to achieve net zero energy for new commercial buildings by 2036. The code trajectory is an important element for new commercial construction in Minnesota's climate action planning. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Graves. And please stick around. Next up, testifying is Elizabeth Turner, AIA Minnesota. Ms. Turner, please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Good afternoon, Chair and members of the committee. My name is Elizabeth Turner, and I am an architect and business owner. On behalf of AIA Minnesota's nearly 2,300 architecture and design professionals, I would like to express our support of HF 831. Because of programs like SB 2030, which governs energy standards in public buildings, we already know we can build more efficient and resilient buildings in a cost-effective way. SB 2030 is both meeting environmental goals and saving the state $22 million each year in operating costs. This program has accelerated the skills of Minnesota's architects in delivering cost-effective, high-performance buildings through improvements to site orientation, massing, building envelope, and mechanical systems. As architects, we greatly value and respect the code-making process. The Department of Labor and Industry conducts a rigorous and thorough evaluation of building code proposals to make sure they work for Minnesota. We know that even on an accelerated pace, this process will retain its thoughtfulness, take all perspectives into consideration, and keep Minnesota's best interests in mind. Accelerating the statewide energy code preserves the existing uniformity and clarity in our code and ensures every community is on a level playing field. If Minnesota does not more rapidly update its commercial building energy standards, we are setting ourselves up to pay more in the future through costly retrofits and increasing energy assistance funding needs. Today's baseline code building is tomorrow's energy assistance request. When lifetime building costs are considered in addition to first costs, investing in building efficiency upfront makes complete financial sense. However, not all developers and design teams have the time, resources, or interest in doing the necessary modeling on every project. So a statewide commercial energy code that keeps pace with advancements in design and technology would help create a clear pathway to energy efficient buildings for everyone. Accelerating the code will also open new opportunities for job training and the skills that will keep Minnesota's design, contracting, building trades, and engineering professions vital in the decades to come. We need to raise the minimum expectation statewide to give every community an opportunity to build better, high-performing buildings to serve their residents. AIA Minnesota's architects ask for your support. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Turners. Member, questions or comments on the bill? Representative Edelson.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative Long, for bringing this bill. I was reviewing it and, of course, added my name to it because I was as a co-author. So it's my understanding, I mean, and it sounds like your testifier said it, is that as you improve the energy efficiency, you also reduce cost. And it sounds like that's something that you guys also looked at. I'm curious, when you went with the working group, if they found any states that were leading the way on this as they were looking at how Minnesota was going to implement this.
Chair Long.
Thank you so much for the question, Representative Edelson. Before I answer the question, I just want to note that the city of Edina is one of the cities that's pushed hard for
the bill, and we've had a diverse coalition of cities from Rochester to Red Wing to St. Paul who have really been the leaders that have brought this proposal forward. I think the most eloquent answer to your question would come from Richard Graves, who really has a good handle on the perspective of other states, so I'll defer to him.
Mr. Graves.
During the working group, we reviewed work going on in New York, Massachusetts, and also in Canada, in British Columbia, as similar policy models to getting the built environment to meet climate action goals and get to net zero. So,
Representative Adelson.
Thank you, Chair. I was just curious so I could read up more on it. And yes, Representative Long, you are right. It is something that we, via city codes, have taken great efforts in. So I love that this is a statewide bill. So very supportive.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question for perhaps one of the testifiers or even Representative Long. What's to preclude the or businesses or the buildings that are being constructed today or even tomorrow from doing this without a state law?
Representative Long or the Chair Long or the testifiers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the question, Representative McDonald. So certainly buildings can go above code if they want to, and they can build more efficient buildings than many are. But we know that as a state, we've set goals for ourselves for our greenhouse reduction that we need to achieve, and we're not on track to meet those. So this is an effort to try to help our state get on track with one of the large sources of energy consumption, which is our commercial buildings.
Representative McDonald.
Good, fair enough, thank you. See, one of the testifiers also mentioned that if we don't do this now, it could be more costly in the future because retrofitting buildings. But in this particular piece of legislation, there is no clawback, if you will, regarding retrofitting if this does not become law. So just curious as to, with your bill, Representative Long, there's no clawback, there's no retrofitting of pre-existing buildings, but in the one of the testifiers said that if we don't do this now, it could be more costly because of retrofitting. So the two has a little bit of a dichotomy there, if you will. Can you explain?
Chair Long.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that the comment was just that it's cheaper to do it at the front end than to retrofit a building. And you're correct, this bill does not apply to existing buildings. This is only for new construction. And so it would, I think, as you heard from the architects, create predictability for builders and others looking for knowing what the energy efficiency codes are going to be for the next 15 years.
Representative McDonald.
That's all I have for now, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Thank you, Representative Long.
Representative Raleigh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've got two areas of question. Can the author define what net zero is trying to get to? Because I'm trying to understand, is it net zero energy? Is it net zero carbon? Or is it all of the above? Thank you.
Chair Long.
Thank you for the question, Representative Raleigh. I think Mr. Graves spoke to that. So it's net zero emissions. So
emissions.
If you you would take all of the cost-effective energy efficiency that you could for the building. And then at that point, if there was a renewable energy source, for example, that was more cost effective than having energy efficiency, then that would be the next step in the process.
Representative Raleigh.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. So that leads me to the question of, is it net zero during construction and during the maintenance phase in the out years? Is it one or the other, or is it both?
Chair Long.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Raleigh. That's a good question. I think Mr. Graves can probably answer that more succinctly than me.
Mr. Graves.
It would be net zero in operation. So after construction, during future years of operations, the building would be generating all the energy it used from renewable sources.
Representative Raleigh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And final question on this. If during the course of operation, so we're going to line out during construction and we're going to be paying attention to operation and maintenance phase. During that phase, if a building is not able to have, like, let's say, renewable energy or whatever, how would they attain a net zero? Are you contemplating things like carbon offsets, or what's the general approach if the energy efficiencies are not available for a particular building, Mr. Chair?
Chair Long.
Thank you for the question, Representative Raleigh. So I think that would be part of the rulemaking that the Department of Labor and Industry would likely undergo, and that would be a rulemaking that would be about 12 years out, but maybe Mr. McClellan would be interested in speaking to that.
Representative Raleigh.
Sure. Mr. Chair, Representative, through rulemaking, each three-year cycle, we'd be putting together a proposal of amendments that would use technology to gain a minimum efficiency every three-year cycle. And when we started to approach the year 2036, that there will become a point where additional technology features for efficiency will need to rely on renewables. So at that point, that's when renewable energy would need to kick in to complete that net zero design of the building. And in the process, when that is being anticipated, the designers of the buildings, the engineers that are designing it, will model the building to determine the best way to accomplish that. And the hope is then once they get into the operational phase, then the building will actually produce net zero. So thank you.
Representative Raleigh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Detmer.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. And it's been brought up in the testimony that there's no net zero with the construction of the buildings. I see that. And has anybody figured out what the increase of cost for operating the building after it's constructed to meet the net zero by 2036? Is there some figures out there what it's going to cost more for the businesses that operate the buildings, that own the buildings? And, that's a good question that people are going to ask. Those are the types of emails I'll probably get as a legislator.
Chair Long.
Thank you for the question, Representative Detmer. Mr. Graves has been tracking costs and can answer that well.
Mr. Graves.
So operating costs would be reduced because they would be generating energy generating their own energy, and so they would be saving in their electrical bills and gas bills because of efficiency and production. What would be increased is the initial capital construction costs. And what we've seen in the SB 2030 program, we're currently doing buildings in the state bonded construction that would be equivalent to the code in 2030. The increased capital construction costs are about 2% for that code level. We'd have to see, as it becomes statewide, all the buildings statewide would increase the scale of construction, and some of those increased capital costs would come down because you'd be doing more buildings. So it remains to be seen what the increased capital construction costs would be in 2033 and 2036.
Representative Detmer.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And what type of energy sources are we talking about? Are we going to have windmills? Are we going to have solar on top of buildings? Or what energy and what backup energy we're going to have? You saw what happened down in Texas, and we're this, that they weren't ready for that, what happened down there. But what type of energy sources are we talking about?
Chair Long.
Thank you for the question, Representative Detmer. So just to put a fine point on it, we're talking about buildings that are for the net zero portion. These are buildings that are 15 years out. So in the near term, we're talking about buildings really only using energy efficiency to achieve the goals. But when we're getting towards net zero, that's when you would be turning over to renewable energy. And so most likely it would be solar. That's what we've seen on most buildings. And in terms of grid reliability, having locally produced solar on buildings in our state actually increases reliability to have that created close to customer load. So that's a positive from a grid standpoint.
Representative Detmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I'll leave it as that. So.
I'm not seeing any other member questions. We'll give it a minute. There is a little bit of time just to make sure. Representative McDonald.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a question. Certainly, I'm in an old 100-year-old building, and I mentioned this to the good architects that I spoke with earlier this week, and it's certainly all for energy efficiency. If you can imagine the cost of my energy in this 100-year-old building with 15-foot ceilings, not that you can see it right now. But if this is definitely going to be energy saving for the buildings and the building owners and passed on to the occupants, wouldn't you believe, Representative Long, that this is something that wouldn't have to be a state mandate? Because if there is indeed the efficiency where it's going to save on your energy bill, then naturally the builder and owners of the building would do this naturally without state interference of a state mandate. Wouldn't you agree with me?
Representative Long.
I think, Mr. Chair, thank you for the question, Representative McDonald. So when folks are building buildings, there's a couple of things that they take into account. And sometimes there's a different incentives for the builders and for the owners. So while it might be cheaper to own the building, if it's more efficient, such as yours, you know, you'd probably want to have a building that's more efficient to own. Sometimes that's not what the builders are looking at. They're looking at just the upfront cost. And for, as Mr. Graves pointed out, just a small increase in upfront costs, the overall cost of operating and maintaining the building goes down pretty dramatically. And so the payback for a lot of these things can be pretty quick, but it's that sort of split incentive between the building owner and the building and the builder itself that creates a challenge. And then, as I mentioned earlier, we also, I think, need to help continue to educate folks about these types of technologies. Some of them are new and some of them are just being rolled out. But I think once we've seen builders use them, like with the SB 2030 program, then we get a lot more comfort with them. And we've seen a lot of folks be willing to use them more readily.
Representative McDonald.
Then real quickly, Mr. Chair, Mr. Representative Long, if the energy savings does not really justify the cost of the buildings, the extra cost to build it down the road, then do they get a refund, if you will, because of the state mandate from DALI or Department of Labor or?
Chair Long.
I know it's something you can answer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't believe there's a mechanism for a refund, but I will note that the way that the net zero works in other states, and as Mr. Graves testified with SB 2030, is that you're using all of the cost-effective energy efficiency before you're going to renewable energy. So if you reach the point of where it's no longer cost-effective to do energy efficiency, which is some of the work that Mr. Snope and his employees do, then you would be turning to renewable energy. And right now, solar energy is getting cheaper every year, and within the next 5 years, folks anticipate it'll be the cheapest energy available. So I'm not particularly concerned about the costs for builders. I think this will be a win-win.
Representative McDonald.
That's all I have, Mr. Chair.
Seeing no other questions or comments, final words, Chair Long.
Thank you so much, Chair Eklund, for hearing the bill. I'm very pleased with where we were able to come after a lot of hard work to bring this coalition together and find a path forward, and grateful for the committee hearing it today.
I will renew my motion that House File 831 be referred to the Climate and Energy Finance and Policy Committee. Ms. Doyle, please take the roll.
Chair Eklund?
Yes.
Eklund, aye. Vice Chair Zhang, excused. Representative Detmer?
Nay.
Detmer, nay. Representative McDonald?
McDonald, nay.
McDonald, nay. Representative Berg?
Berg, aye.
Berg, aye. Representative Bliss?
Nay.
Bliss, nay. Representative Edelson?
Aye.
Edelson, aye. Representative Frederick?
Aye.
Frederick, aye. Representative Greenman?
Aye.
Greenman, aye. Representative Nelson?
Nelson, aye.
Nelson, aye. Representative Poston?
No.
Poston, nay. Representative Raleigh?
Raleigh, nay.
Raleigh, nay. Representative Sundin?
Aye.
Sundin, aye. And there are 7 ayes, 5 nays.
Between 7 ayes and 5 nays, the motion is passed and the bill is on its way. Representative Long, thank you. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Members, next bill on the agenda is House File 600. I will move that House File 600 be referred to the Workforce and Business Development, Finance and Policy Committee. Representative Winkler, we have the A8 author's amendment. Would you like to explain the amendment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, the A8 amendment updates the bill to reflect in the first section that veterans should not need to send medical records to the Cannabis Management Board in order to qualify for the medical cannabis program. So we make that correction. Second part of the amendment essentially changes the bill so that existing apprenticeship programs and systems within DLI will be used for cannabis apprenticeship programs as well. They will develop the apprenticeship program with the industry and fold that into their existing programs, and the appropriation allows them the funds to do that.
I will move the adoption of the A8 Author's Amendment for House File 600. All those in favor say aye. Aye.
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay. The amendment is adopted. Representative Winkler, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I appreciate your time and attention on House File 600 today. As you know, this bill creates a framework for legalizing cannabis, expunging criminal records related to cannabis crimes. It creates a new industry in Minnesota built on equitable principles, including that those who have been most adversely affected by our current cannabis prohibition should be among those who participate in the success of a new industry. We have a labor peace provisions in the bill. We have updates to the medical cannabis program, which very much align with what Representative Edelson is carrying as a separate standalone bill. And I think it's important to note, Mr. Chair, and I'll try to be brief and allow maximum time for public testimony. This bill is not about whether we are pro or anti-cannabis in Minnesota. It's not a bill to make cannabis widespread in Minnesota, because it already is. Minnesotans use cannabis for a variety of reasons. It is commonly available for youth. It is commonly available for seniors with health issues. It's commonly available for veterans for various reasons. It's commonly used and equally used in the African-American community along with the white community in Minnesota. And the fact of the matter is that our laws are the part of this system that don't work. We criminalize responsible adults who use cannabis for their own purposes. We criminalize people who use cannabis for their health benefits. We criminalize veterans who use cannabis as an alternative to opioids. And we criminalize countless African Americans because of their participation in a substance that is common. So we did 15 stops around Minnesota. We've had hundreds of hours of work with community groups, advocacy organizations. And in all the time that I've been working on this bill since the summer of 2019, I haven't heard a single person say a single positive thing about our current cannabis laws. They do not work. None of the goals of people who are concerned about cannabis are met by our current laws. So as we look at making updates to the way we treat cannabis, and we look at ways to make responsible, smart policy choices, we have to make sure that we are actually dealing with cannabis as it is, not as people believed it to be during a period of reefer madness in the 20th century. Things are not that way. So this bill has a number of provisions that relate to this committee, as I mentioned. One thing I would like to particularly note, we want to create social equity applications and give priority to people who've been hurt by the war on drugs. Among those who are considered to be social equity applicants for licenses to participate in the cannabis industry are veterans who have lost honorable status due to cannabis offenses. So particularly in this committee, in addition to the racial equity provisions, we want to make sure that veterans who have been harmed because of their use of cannabis, which is in many cases a healthy, safer alternative to the prescription drugs handed out freely at the VA, are part of the success of a future cannabis industry. And so with that, Mr. Chair, I will allow the testifiers to go forward and happy to answer questions and address any issues that the committee may raise.
Thank you, Majority Leader Winkler. Committee members and staff and members of the public here to testify today. We have 15 people registered to testify on this bill. All the testifiers have been notified that they will have 3 minutes each. Committee Administrator Reese will keep track of the time. Once you start, he will begin your time. When you have 30 seconds remaining, he will hold up this sign. High tech here. When your 3 minutes are up, we'll hold up the stop sign. Please conclude your testimony at that time. If you have further comments, please email them to Committee Administrator Reese, and he can share them with the committee afterwards. I will be calling out three testifiers at a time, so the next two after the first one will be ready to testify. So first up is Robert Lopez, United Food and Commercial Workers Union, followed by Steve Colina and Nathan Knoll. Mr. Lopez, please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Chairman Eklund. My name is Robert Lopez. I'm with the United Food and Commercial Workers International Union. I'm here today on behalf of UFCW and UFCW Local 1189. UFCW Local 1189 represents over 8,000 members here in Minnesota, while UFCW International represents nearly 1.3 million workers nationwide. UFCW represents hardworking men and women in highly regulated industries, including the emerging legal cannabis industry. We know how to support workers in tightly regulated industries, and that is why wherever cannabis is legalized, the UFCW is committed to building family-sustaining jobs and a strong, diverse, and skilled workforce. UFCW supports HF 600 because it includes strong labor peace language, which is good for cannabis workers and the industry. It is no surprise that multiple other states have chosen to include labor peace agreements for cannabis licensure. California, New Jersey, and New York all require cannabis operators to sign agreements requiring labor peace. Pennsylvania and Illinois incentivize operators with a merit-based system that gives points for labor peace agreements. Each of these states face similar questions and arguments about labor peace, and each of these states agreed that labor peace agreements in cannabis were good and consistent with state and federal law. Labor peace is not forcing unionization. It simply levels the playing field. The emerging cannabis industry is a job generator, and we want those to be good paying jobs. The legal marijuana industry added 77,000 new jobs in 2020, and that is during a pandemic. Nationally, the industry supports about 321,000 jobs, and that's growing at a very rapid pace. Studies have also shown that unionized workers enjoy wages higher than their non-union counterparts and pay far less for medical and retirement benefits. Unions also enhance worker satisfaction and lead to higher productivity and lower turnover. Labor peace helps counter the impact of the war on drugs by ensuring good paying jobs for those communities disproportionately impacted. The work unions have done on behalf of workers in the state of Minnesota has led to a culture that values organized labor and the right to organize free from interference. We must continue that tradition. The emerging cannabis industry presents an unparalleled opportunity to build a new kind of industry for Minnesota, one that recognizes the importance unions play and gives workers an opportunity to exercise workplace democracy and improve both the industry and Minnesota communities. Policymakers must embrace this opportunity to build workplace democracy into the fabric of this new industry. In conclusion, UFCW supports an adult use cannabis industry in Minnesota that will create sustainable jobs for families, reward responsible businesses, and ensure that Minnesota cannabis industry is driven by companies committed to making long-term investments in local communities. That is why we urge you to pass HF 600 with labor peace this session. Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today, and I look forward to answering any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Lopez. Next up is Steve Colina, President, CEO of Minnesota Precision Manufacturers Association. Mr. Colina, please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Steve Colina. I'm the president and CEO of the Minnesota Precision Manufacturing Association. We're precision manufacturers producing the most complex and critical products in regulated industries such as med device, aerospace, and defense. Being a manufacturer myself, I do speak with hundreds of businesses each year. Some do see positives with House File 600, such as the decriminalization and more access for medicinal purposes. However, there are three concerns that I'm going to cover. First, the most important being safety. Some of the most intelligent, talented people are machinists and toolmakers that run million-dollar machines, making devices that save lives or keep a plane up in the sky. One wrong move can cause a $50,000 repair. One bad product could cause a plane to crash or kill a patient. Allowing recreational marijuana risks workers' safety, millions of dollars in capital, and most importantly, the quality of products that could cost lives. What are manufacturers looking for in an employee? They show up on time, are highly focused, detail-oriented, efficient, and have the ability to react to problems. Ask yourself, would you want someone under the influence producing the life-saving device that goes into your child or assembling the brake lines in your car? Second issue is testing. So last week, Representative Winkler mentioned there is no correlation between the amount of THC in someone's system and their level of impairment. When asked how the bill would address detection, he mentioned that it will fund police training. That does help, but as a military policeman myself, I can tell you that training for detection is not an objective measurement. Now, place that same burden on thousands of businesses. 80% of Minnesota manufacturers have 50 employees or less. They don't have trained experts to detect impairment, let alone on a substance that is almost impossible to quantify or prove. I hope you'll demand further testing capabilities or risk leaving our employers to fend for themselves when it comes to the safety of employees or potential litigation over product quality or employment lawsuits. Who will be accountable? Lastly, on jobs. One of the arguments is that this will generate more revenue and jobs. I want to be clear, Minnesota does not need more jobs. What we need is an efficient allocation of trained people where they are needed. Like many industries, manufacturing is short tens of thousands of workers, and with baby boomers retiring, it's getting worse. Does trimming cannabis really sound like a rewarding career path? Because we have precision machining jobs paying $70,000 to $80,000, and we have lots of those jobs available today. In the end, assuming this or another bill, similar bill, eventually moves forward, we simply ask that it provides a better understanding of testing and impairment and support and guidance for employers. We're not looking to fight social battles. We understand there's needs for cannabis. However, we need to make sure that employers have good guidance and good abilities to take care of their employees and ensure that they're not at risk themselves. So, Mr. Chair, committee members, I thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Kalina. And I see Representative Bliss has his hand up. We're going to hear the testifiers first. So testifiers, please stick around in case a question pertains to you. Next up is Nathan Knoll. After Mr. Knoll is Michael Dobb, Rachel Jacobson, and Ken Winters. Mr. Knoll, please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Nathan Noel. I come here today to voice my support for Minnesota recreational cannabis industry that is safe for its workers. That is why I support the labor peace language in House File 600. Labor peace agreements ensure that cannabis jobs will be safe and well-paid. I have lived in Minnesota my entire life and am raising my 3-year-old and 8-year-old daughters in Minneapolis. I joined the UFCW in 2015 and was part of the inaugural class of cannabis workers for Local 1189. Officially, I am the fifth cannabis worker to join the union. I work in one of the greenhouses here. I spend sunrise on Sunday mornings ensuring plants are fed and the environments are to spec to allow our crops to reach their maximum potential. Our team of 10 works every day to ensure the raw material for our patients is always in supply. We are fortunate to be somewhat isolated from COVID-19 as our secure facilities require masks, gloves, strict sanitation protocols, and temperature scans prior to entrance. While working, we are reasonably able to socially distance in the greenhouses. Working for a physician-led organization that believes in its workers and the power of the plant we produce has been great for my family. I'm exceptionally fortunate for the opportunity to work with and for such amazing people in light supplemented greenhouses that are warm and sunny 365 days a year to produce such an amazing plant. I support labor peace agreements in the cannabis industry because they help make sure my workplace is safe. At our greenhouse, we have a joint labor management board that meets quarterly to address health and safety issues. That board would not exist without the union, and I would not have that venue to talk about the health and safety concerns of my colleagues without a union. Cannabis is agriculture and therefore has many safety concerns. The greenhouses require specific environmental conditions for cannabis plants to thrive. Workers can sometimes be exposed to unusual heat temperatures, strenuous working conditions, and hazardous cleaning agents between harvests. We are able to voice safety concerns at the Joint Labor Management Board meetings. Another common concern is ergonomics. My coworkers have had issues with being overburdened with repetitive packaging tasks. These tasks can lead to long-term injuries. We're able to bring up to the board, and workers are now given alternating tasks throughout the day to reduce the chance of workplace injuries. The Joint Labor Management Board allows workers to address health and safety concerns with management on a regular basis. I know the cannabis industry is a job generator, and I want those to be safe jobs. Because of my job in cannabis, I can support my family and cultivate a workplace that empowers workers. Please pass House File 600 today, and thank you for the opportunity to comment.
Thank you, Mr. Noel. Next up is Michael Dobb. Mr. Dobb, please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for committee members for the opportunity to speak today. My name is Michael Daub. I'm a drug and substance use disorder policy advocate. I believe at this point in time, Minnesota sits at a crossroads. Cannabis legalization brings with it difficult legal and policy challenges. Although Minnesota partially decriminalized marijuana in 1976, the legalization movement never really gained much momentum. Although federal law criminalizes marijuana in a variety of different ways, the budding experiment to legalize marijuana has not withered on the vine. Legalization efforts have taken root nationally, spreading like a weed. As the National Conference on State Legislatures puts it, marijuana has lit up conversations and controversy across the country. It's a hotly contested and complicated issue for states to weed through, and no doubt will remain high on legislative agendas for the foreseeable future. I believe that Minnesota needs to be educated with the research and science that clearly establishes that there's a harm to public health caused by marijuana use. Research and science do not support the widespread legalization and commercial sale of marijuana. I'm allied with a number of organizations that oppose the widespread legalization and commercial sale of marijuana as proposed in House File 600, and hold with those that believe that further decriminalization beyond that which was accomplished in 1976 and expungement of certain convictions should strongly be considered. I believe that at today's hearing, you're likely to hear testimony about why marijuana should be legalized and commercialized because it'll be more easily facilitate access by veterans. Veterans should be honored for their service to our country. We all want to help veterans, but marijuana legalization and commercial sale may actually do more harm than help. The belief that marijuana can be used to treat PTSD, for example, is limited to anecdotal reports from individuals with PTSD who say that the drug helps with their symptoms. There's been no randomized control trials, a necessary gold standard for determining efficacy. I testified a number of years ago before the FDA involving the efficacy and use of a medical product of an opioid, and it was a remarkable experience. And the fact that that's not being done and has not been done when it comes to marijuana is simply astonishing. Some veterans use marijuana to relieve symptoms of PTSD.
Mr. Dobb, if you please wrap up, your 3 minutes is up.
Yes, thank you. I'll wrap it up by saying, to be blunt, the overall drug policy should be used to reduce drug use and connect those who are suffering from substance use disorders with recovery. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Dobb. And if you have more comments, you can submit them to the Travis Reese, our committee administrator, and we'll share with the committee. Appreciate your testimony. Next up, Rachel Jacobson. Ms. Jacobson, please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Rachel Jacobson. As a resident of Prior Lake, I come here today to voice my support for the recreational cannabis industry in Minnesota that creates quality jobs. That is why I support the labor peace language in House File 600. Labor peace agreements ensure that these jobs will be well-paid, family-sustaining jobs. I have lived in Minnesota my entire life. I joined the UFCW in 2018 and work in one of the retail medical cannabis dispensaries. It has been challenging working through the COVID-19 pandemic and interacting with the patients on a daily at the busiest location in the state. With the governor's executive order in place, we offer vestibule pickup instead of patients coming into the dispensary to pick up their cannabis products. We also offer curbside pickup where we bring the medication onto their vehicle, which can be tedious on cold days. As a patient care coordinator, I fill orders, dispense medication, and answer remaining questions patients may have. On a busy day, we see over 100 patients. We work 8-hour shifts with paid lunches. There are typically 3 patient care coordinators working at a time to guarantee breaks. I support labor peace agreements in the cannabis industry because it will lead to good jobs. I know that cannabis is a growing industry with the potential to create a lot of quality jobs here in Minnesota, jobs like mine that are good paying jobs. Through the union, we bargain for annual raises so that my income is sustainable and I have access to affordable health insurance. We have employees who have been working here since the medical cannabis program started in 2015 because there's an incentive to stay at this union job year after year. I believe that we have a very low turnover rate because we are union and have guaranteed wage increases and benefits compared to non-union workplaces. My employer recently changed the retail name of their locations to Green Goods. This says to me that employers are adjusting to the new landscape and getting ready for adult recreational legalization. As the industry grows, I want other workers to be able to join a union and have access to a collective bargaining agreement. Without a union, I would not have a voice in the workplace, and neither would my coworkers. My union has allowed me access to a job that provides a living wage, health and safety training, and a union benefits package. I want this for new recreational cannabis workers too. Please vote yes to pass House File 600 today, and thank you for allowing me the opportunity to comment.
Thank you, Ms. Jacobson. Next up is Ken Winters, PhD, and before Mr. Winters, or Dr. Winters, the next three will be Marcus Harkis, George Realmuto, and Jeremy Mohn, and if I butcher your names, I so apologize. Mr. Winters, please, or Dr. Winters, please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Chair, and the committee members for this opportunity to provide my views on House File 600. I am Ken Winters, trained in clinical psychology and a longstanding addiction researcher. For 25 years, I conducted this research while on faculty in the Department of Psychiatry at the University of Minnesota. I co-founded, along with Judson Bemis, an action group called Smart Approaches to Marijuana Minnesota. Our group does not support the commercialization of cannabis for adults, but we do favor the improvement of Minnesota's medical marijuana program and reviewing Minnesota's existing decriminalization laws. If one were to follow the science, it is my view that there is no health justification for commercializing the sale of cannabis to adults. There is now substantial evidence as to the negative effects of cannabis use on health and well-being, including risk for addiction, damage to the developing brain of adolescents, impaired driving, and elevated risk for mental illness. All of these risks are elevated when people are using higher intensity THC. There's now robust literature on that. As for the potential medical value of cannabis for veterans, I have three thoughts. My understanding of the research-based science is that a moderate degree of evidence exists for the medical value of cannabis for non-cancer related pain. But the evidence is very mixed as to the possible benefit of cannabis use for PTSD. And some studies have shown an increase in PTSD symptoms after cannabis use. If veterans are not getting sufficient access to the Minnesota Medical Marijuana Program, then the program should be fixed. I do not see how it is logical or ethical to commercialize a product outside a medical structure in order to make it easier for anyone to use it as medicine. The Minnesota Medical Marijuana Program should convene medical experts and provide an updated review of the latest science-based research on cannabis use as medicine for veterans. And the program's oversight group needs to address the problem of accessibility and affordability. Simply put, supporting this commercialization bill is a bad idea. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Dr. Winters. Mr. Harkis, please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Hey, my name is Marcus Harkis. I'm a family man, writer, organizer, and social entrepreneur from North Minneapolis. I'm also the director of the Campaign for Full Legalization. For the past 7 years, I've studied the history of prohibition and the emerging legal cannabis industry. At 20 years old, I began smoking herb as a safer alternative to alcohol and to treat my post-traumatic stress from being excessively harassed by police in my youth and 20s. And I've never been a criminal. Police have pulled me over 70 times, racial profiling me 50 of those times in vehicles and on foot. I was once violently brutalized by Minneapolis cops along the curb on Plymouth Avenue during a blizzard. I once experienced being berated and sexually assaulted by a vicious female U of M cop who caught me and a woman peacefully smoking by the Mississippi River. As a Black man and a cannabis consumer for the past 22 years, I know that too many police officers are corruptly addicted to the war on drugs. Thousands of veterans have been victims of the drug war, including those like Jeremy who were discharged from military service over consumption of cannabis, a healing plant with no lethal dose. The most dangerous thing about cannabis is getting caught with it because you can lose your freedom, lose your job, lose your housing, and even lose custody rights of your children. We all know about the prevalence of PTSD among veterans and the tragic fact that 22 veterans die by suicide every day in the USA because of it. Because of prohibition, veterans are not free to consume cannabis without risking their careers during active duty or their VA benefits in retirement. Dozens of Minnesota veterans have shared their testimonies with me of how THC has been the only substance to effectively treat their PTSD, including a good friend of mine who is a successful, nationally respected professional whose biggest secret is that smoking herb every night after work helps him relax, enjoy private fellowship, and endure his haunting trauma to help him sleep. As the grandson of two foreign war veterans who returned home with PTSD and became alcoholics and tobacco smokers, I've often wondered if cannabis had been legal and safely accessible then, if my grandfathers would have lived longer, healthier lives. Ironically, cannabis is an exit drug, not a so-called gateway drug. Trauma is the real gateway to drug addiction. We know that many veterans, like my extraordinary friend, are thriving partly because cannabis has helped increase the peace in their wounded hearts and minds, as it has with millions of civilians, including myself. Soldiers are men and women willing to make the ultimate sacrifice of their lives for our country. This is supposed to be a free country they defend, not a police state that disenfranchises us. It's time to end the drug war now. Prohibition is the problem, not cannabis. Please pass House File 600. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Harkus. Next up is Dr. Realmuto, and I apologize. Doctor, please identify yourself for the record and proceed. We will come back to him, and if we're having technical difficulties, I
got it. Sorry.
Okay. That's all right.
I was thinking you were going to unmute me. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for this opportunity to testify on House File 600. I am Dr. George Realmuto. You've done very well pronouncing my name. Professor Emeritus of Psychiatry at the University of Minnesota. For a dozen years, I was the medical director of the state's psychiatric facility for children and adolescents in Wilmer. In that capacity, I treated adolescents who appeared to have severe schizophrenia, except their psychosis was initiated by high potency cannabis. They remained in hospital for months, while non-cannabis patients with schizophrenia stayed in hospital for 1 to 2 weeks. I oppose opening up the state to recreational marijuana because of the difficulties of accessing evidence-based addiction services, and because veterans and adolescents and young people are uniquely vulnerable to addictive substances. Adolescents have no rules for the amount of the addictive substance they consume. They feel indestructible and are heavily influenced by society and peers. They often will oppose treatment even when family and teachers see the problem. Veterans, and this is from my reading of the psychiatric literature, who experience war situations that required high levels of vigilance. That's what makes them uniquely susceptible to post-traumatic stress disorder. And this illness can be a barrier to accept care. They are trained to suppress negative emotions to improve success in combat. Lack of access to their psychological understanding of themselves can be a barrier to accessing care. These developmental learned traits and illnesses for both young people and veterans are impediments to their perception and self-assessment of the problem of addiction and their engagement with treatment services. Adding a new addictive substance to our society without first robustly funding prevention, education, and early intervention is unethical. A review and revision of the medical cannabis program is necessary. Adding recreational cannabis as a method of decreasing the cost of medical cannabis creates an enormous set of harms to solve a narrow business issue. Thank you for your attention. I'll accept questions at the end. Thank you.
Thank you, Doctor, for your testimony. Next up is Jeremy Mullen, and then the next three after that are Jeremy Sankey, Ryan Schmidt, Joanna Lester. Mr. Mullen, please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Hello. Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee. My name is Jeremy Mullen. I'm here to testify on behalf of HF 600. I myself am a veteran, and I was removed from enlistment due to cannabis use. Throughout my military career, you know, I had some issues with alcohol, and I switched to cannabis because I was actually less careless when I was using cannabis. My story is I was in basic training in December of 1997, I was put on Christmas leave to go home. I'm 42 years old, man, and I still choke up. And it was Christmas exodus leave from basic training. I was at Sand Hill, Fort Benning, Georgia. I got to go home, and on the 29th of December, I was bringing my grandma home from Christmas at my parents' house in Cloquet, going down Highway 2. And in Floodwood, there was an old truck stop called Bud's Place, had a little cafe and stuff. And my grandma had just asked me to turn the radio up. Well, my grandma being a 30-year organ player in church, you know, I really didn't think she was going to ask me to turn up Guns N' Roses, but she did. And when I reached down, I turned it up, and I looked up. We ran into the ass end of a semi that was turning into Bud's Place. I'm going to make this quick because I got a few little points to make, but my grandma didn't make it to the hospital that day. And literally, when it comes right down to it, there are days I can't kick it out of my head. I usually always have a little bit of cannabis with me and one puff, and I can go about whatever I'm doing. It gives my brain enough time to shut up, shut off, and go do what I can do. I can grow this in my backyard if I'm allowed. And I don't have to go out, and I don't have to deal with the public if I'm having one of those anxiety out days. I could just sit there, stay at home, do what I need to do, raise my kids, raise my family, and be who I need to be. Because some days there are those days where you don't want to go out in public because there's such a stigma between the cliques and communities that I don't agree with what you do, so I'm just going to sit here and be really loud about it. Well, that's okay. I don't care if people don't agree with it. That doesn't bug me one bit. But don't agree with it quieter, because I don't agree with some things you do too. And that's part of society in general, you know. We have all these cliques in society, and we all just have to learn to work together. Sometimes we have to learn to let the some things go so we can use the better parts. It's how life is.
Mr. Mullen, can we please wrap up?
Yes, sir. That was basically, it helps me calm down. It helps me stay on an even keel. And I wish that everybody would just learn to mind, watch their own bobber, you know, because sometimes everybody else just let them do what they do. You know,
thank you, Mr. Mullen. And if you have more comments, you can certainly submit them to our
committee. I'll be here. Thank you.
Thank you for your time. Next up is Jeremy Sankey. Mr. Sankey, please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Mr. Chair, committee members, thank you. Jeremy Sankey, founder of Minnesota Veterans for Cannabis. Over the last 5 years or so, we've spoken to or communicated with almost 15,000 veterans in the state of Minnesota who use cannabis for medicinal reasons. Some of those veterans, they'll use the state program, but a majority of them do not for two main reasons. One, the cost, and then two, the fact that they're asked to pay hundreds of dollars a month for cannabis when the VA obviously is still handing out pills for free every day. This is a quality of life issue for veterans. And to those that say cannabis doesn't help with PTSD, let me tell you, the number of 22 veterans a day would be a lot higher, a lot higher. Even though cannabis can help veterans immensely, people associate cannabis with crime. It's actually prohibition that creates the crime. If we were good at learning from history and we studied alcohol prohibition thoroughly and its unforeseen consequences, we would see that prohibition is the problem, not cannabis. Even though cannabis can help veterans immensely, some would say in the legal states, there's bad things going on. Well, I've been there. I've spoken with lawmakers on both sides of the aisle. And in my best Chicken Little impersonation, I'll say the sky has not fallen. Even though cannabis could help veterans immensely, people worry about the kids getting a hold of it. Well, the kids already get a hold of it now. I used to be concerned about kids getting a hold of it, but now I'm more concerned about what they're getting now rather than the fact they're getting it. A well-regulated, monitored, legal market helps out a lot of people with public health issues, especially when it comes to kids. Instead of getting tainted or counterfeit products, they're getting something that's regulated and monitored. In reference to something that was said earlier, we already have a recreational market in Minnesota. That's not going away. The one we have now is just illegal. We're just asking it to make it legal. And I would say, you know, yeah, we make it legal, the cost of medical cannabis comes down, but that's already done in the medical community. I mean, in the pharmacy at Walgreens and CVS, you've got medications that are behind the counter and ones that are over the counter. The over-the-counter medications you don't need a script for. It comes with directions. Use it yourself. We're asking the committee members to support House File 600 just like we do. We're asking you to support veterans. We're asking you to forget everything you've ever been told about cannabis, because most of it was a lie. If I was working in the addiction industry, obviously I would be against the legalization cannabis bill because I get paid by people being addicted to drugs. But that's not the case. Yes. Like I said, we're asking you guys to support this bill and to vote yes. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Next up is Ryan Schmidt. Mr. Schmidt, please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Mr. Chair, he emailed me and said he may have to jump off for a doctor's appointment. So he'll either submit something in writing or he'll sign up at the next committee stop. So it doesn't appear that he is here anymore.
Thank you, Mr. Reese. Next up is Joanna Lester. And after Ms. Lester will be Stephen Egan, Alex Miller, and Maren Schroeder. Ms. Lester, please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Hi. Good afternoon, Chairman Eklund and committee members. My name is Johanna Lester. I'm a former research interviewer in public health and medicine at the University of Minnesota. I'm here to testify in opposition to the bill. In my job at the University of Minnesota, I was a member of AFSCME. What we need in our workforce is people who are educated and healthy. This bill does nothing to promote either. The so-called labor peace agreement prohibits labor organizations and members from boycotts or picketing the cannabis production. This agreement means that cannabis workers have fewer labor rights. Even most essential workers in healthcare or education are not prohibited from striking or protesting. Why is this special treatment for the production of a recreational product? A healthcare professional who certifies qualifying medical conditions is prohibited from holding an economic interest in the manufacture of cannabis. My question is, can and do legislators who vote on this issue own interests in the marijuana industry or receive money from its lobbyists? My brother was a disabled veteran. He came home a chain smoker and a schizophrenic. He died at 50. Cigarettes were highly available in the Army at that time. They were promoted. They've killed a lot of people. Veterans don't need access to more poison and a substance which alters the function of the mind. They need adequate medical and psychiatric care without undue hassle. They need it to be accessible and where they are. They need adequate rehabilitation and mental health care, not available to my brother even years ago. They don't need a drug which federally is not legal, not FDA approved, and is essentially experimental. It does not make sense to use vulnerable, wounded veterans as a medical experiment for the benefit of the marijuana industry. This bill is extensive. It obviously required many hours of preparation. In the past year, we've experienced over 480,000 cases of COVID-19 and over 6,000 deaths. As a state and a nation, we were unprepared for this pandemic. There was a lack of expertise and a lack of recognition of the science, which might help limit the pandemic. Given the gravity of our situation now, the real need to spend money and time on infrastructure, improving healthcare access, the importance of getting everyone vaccinated, why is this bill, which is for recreation of a few at the expense of many of the rest of us, been given such priority? We need quality housing that people can afford.
Ms. Lester, can you please wrap up?
Sure. What I would like to know is why attention such as has been given to this bill is not been given to things like housing and transportation or even to potholes. Thank you for the opportunity to speak here today.
Thank you, Ms. Lester. Next up is Mr. Stephen Egan. Mr. Egan, please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee, for allowing me to speak. My name is Stephen Egan. I am a Minnesotan and a veteran. Currently, I'm out of state consulting in the cannabis industry, teaching other labs how to remediate residual content from their oils for medical use. I got out of the Army in 2015 and moved to Minnesota specifically because it was my home and they had a medical cannabis program. When I got out, I wasn't normal. I came out really bad off. My wife had to essentially ensure I brushed my teeth every day for the first 2 years of my ETS. As I became more familiar with cannabis use and got my dose corrected, the world for me began to change. Once I realized how beneficial this plant was, I wanted to give it to everybody. So I learned as much as I could as far as this plant is concerned, whether it be the cultivation or the extraction. And now I employ myself and others in this industry and support my family. Unfortunately, I cannot do it at home in Minnesota. I have to travel around the country, take myself and other veterans away from their families so they can provide for their families. This plant is therapeutic. It helps. It saves lives. For those of you that aren't veterans that were speaking on our behalf, thank you, but I'm telling you the plant works. Anecdotal evidence is much larger. Dr. Mashulam has been providing information for decades about the quality and the benefit of this plant. As far as jobs are concerned, sure, trimming isn't the funnest and it doesn't pay the best. However, I can tell you that there are people making excess of $150,000 a year as technicians within this industry, making quality products for patients and recreational users. There are entry-level jobs just like anywhere else, but there are C-level jobs in this position in this industry as well. You know, supporting HF600 is just the right thing to do. It's time that Minnesota gets on board and starts getting with the rest of the country and generating income and providing jobs for its people. Thank you. That's all I have.
Thank you, Mr. Egan. Next up is Alex Miller. Please, Mr. Identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Hello, Mr. Chairman, committee members. My name is Alex Miller. I served 10 years in the Minnesota Army National Guard. I joined on February 16, 2011. I was involved in an incident in July of 2012, less than 6 months after returning home from getting my advanced individual training as a combat medic. In that accident, I broke three vertebrae, my T4, 5, and 6. They have 80% wedge fractures throughout. And daily, I deal with excruciating back pain, debilitating back pain. This affected me for the last 10 years while I was in the military. They tell you to embrace the suck, and that's exactly what I did. I pushed through every ounce of pain to the point where I was breaking myself. About 3 years ago, at a particular low point, I was offered to try it as I was bedridden, and I had a little bit of a break before my next drill, and so I decided to try it, even though I was in the military at the time, and I was up and walking around the next day. The pain wasn't gone, but it helped big time. Over the course of that 10 years, I saw many civilian and military doctors for this pain, and the best that I was offered was painkillers or ibuprofen. I turned down painkillers because addiction wasn't something that I wanted to live with. And so I did ibuprofen to the point where it tore a hole in my stomach. I now have chronic acid reflux. I wake up in the middle of the night because I've aspirated. I've breathed in my stomach acid because of how bad this has made me. I now... ETS'd in August 16th of 2020. Since then, I have not taken ibuprofen once. I have not missed a day of work because of pain. My girlfriend says she feels like she got me back, and I just returned home from a trip from Colorado last night when I received this phone call to ask if I could speak here today. With the potential of moving out there, just so that I don't have to fear for my freedom in a state that says that I can't use a product that I can grow in my backyard. I just want to say that I'm very happy that I was asked to speak about this. This is something that I'm very passionate about. And I'm closing up here. I just want to say thank you again for the opportunity.
Thank you, Mr. Miller. Next up is Maren Schroeder. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Chair Eklund and members of the committee, my name is Maren Schroeder, and I am the Policy Director for Sensible Change Minnesota, an organization that is working primarily to improve access to medical cannabis, prevent accidental drug overdoses, and reduce the harms of our inequitable criminal justice system. I am also a medical cannabis patient with PTSD, resulting after several years of domestic abuse and stalking. I'm also the daughter of an Army veteran and former Teamster. Thank you for letting me speak today. I began my advocacy work in 2014 with our sister organization, Sensible Minnesota. When Minnesota's medical cannabis program started up, we saw a huge need for patient advocates to help patients navigate the oftentimes complicated process of registering as a patient. In that work, which I led for 2 years, I spoke with countless veterans across the state facing severe PTSD and pain disorders who are stuck in a system that just doesn't work for them. HF600 gives Minnesota an opportunity to right the wrongs of prohibition. Patients, including veterans with PTSD and chronic pain, who have been paying some of the highest prices in the country for medical cannabis, will have safer and more affordable access. We will also create thousands of good union jobs in the new industry. In the upper Midwest, Michigan created over 18,000 jobs, which is roughly equal to the number of auto repair mechanics in a state well known for its auto industry. opponents to legalization ignore the reality that hundreds of thousands of Minnesotans are already using cannabis, risking contaminated products and even arrest for their use. Veterans are forced to pay exorbitant prices for medical cannabis, compromise their freedom and safety purchasing from the illicit market, or take unsafe prescription opiates. Medical cannabis works. According to a 2019 report by the Minnesota Department of Health on PTSD in Minnesota's medical cannabis program, 76% of our Minnesota PTSD patients indicated they receive a high degree of benefit from medical cannabis, and their healthcare providers agreed. Now it's high time Minnesota leave our failed prohibition policies in the past, and I want to thank you for the time today.
Thank you, Ms. Schroeder, for your testimony. We're at the end of the test fires. Majority Leader Winkler, before we go to any member comments, do you have any comments on what you've heard so far?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Just a couple of points. Mr. Kalina from the Precision Manufacturers, I think, first of all, I appreciate keeping the focus on labor and veterans here. Mr. Kalina from the Precision Manufacturers raised the question of safety-sensitive positions. And in fact, the bill as drafted permits employers who have safety-sensitive positions to include cannabis testing as part of the criteria for being able to work. So that concern is addressed in the bill after extensive work through legislators and listening to the concerns of the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce and others. So we do preserve the right for employers to test for cannabis when it's appropriate to do so. But like alcohol or prescription drugs, it is legal. It's a legal substance. So simply having it in your system, if it is not safety related, is not grounds for termination or discipline in the workplace. So that is addressed. And a number of comments related to opposition to the bill, I think, were focused on health in general and youth access. Those are real concerns and bear further conversation, particularly in health committees when we will get to those committees. But I do want to just say that the concerns about youth access, driving under the influence and psychological conditions, those concerns are real. And all of those problems exist with our current criminalized prohibition approach to this issue. The bill that we are bringing forward today doesn't take those harms away, in fact, but it does help to address them by providing actual education standards and youth outreach with real information, by providing additional funding for substance use disorder and other kinds of treatment, and by providing additional training for law enforcement for impaired driving. So the impaired driving comment that was referenced is related to driving. In the workplace, it's a separate matter, and that is covered in the bill. So those were a few of the concerns raised. They are legitimate, but all of them are included with policy responses in this bill already.
Thank you, Majority Leader Winkler. Members, we have gotten okay for a few more minutes from House IT. We have several member questions, so please remember to keep it to the view of this committee, which are Section 4 and Section 7 of the bill. Representative Bliss, to your question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the author, Representative Winkler, you know, it was brought up, and you just mentioned it again, you know, the safety concerns on a job. I ran a large IT shop, which covered a lot of driving, people driving, also people working around electronic equipment. I don't know if that was considered safety work or not, but And it also goes with a impaired driving or any time you're working impaired. Right now, it's an objective test. I'm sorry, a subjective test. Or if the law enforcement officer, or me as a boss, if I look at you and I think you're impaired, I can get you in to get a UA. And if it comes back positive, you're considered guilty. If this becomes law, I have no ability to test anybody in a subjective or an objective matter that isn't unfair to the person as well as the employer. I don't really care what you do at your house on the weekend. If it helps you with pain, hey, power to you. And as a side note, I think we should be lowering the price of medical cannabis rather than doing this. But what provisions in the bill provide for better testing. This is, I cannot support this until we get some sort of test similar to what we have for alcohol impairment with medical marijuana or with recreational marijuana. Do you have any idea of when that test might be available?
Majority Leader Winkler.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bliss, nice to meet you. I don't think we've ever actually met before. First I would direct you to page 144 of the bill, which specifically says that an employer, this is 144.5, an employer may request or require an employee to undergo cannabis testing conducted by a testing laboratory if the employer has a reasonable suspicion that the employee is working under the influence of cannabis or is impaired by cannabis, has it violated work rules, has sustained a personal injury, or is in a safety-sensitive position. So we actually do preserve exactly what you're described in this bill in the workplace. That alcohol is not directly applicable. What's unusual about alcohol of all substances that could have you under the influence is that there is a very high correlation between your level of alcohol in the blood and your level of impairment. Those two things are very closely correlated in an objective manner. And that's why we can have something like a blood alcohol test, whether it's a breathalyzer at the side of the road or a blood test. So if you have prescription drugs in your system, if you are overly tired, if you have some other kind of impairment, none of those things meet the same standard of being testable like alcohol is, but they are all a basis or a cause for impairment. Cannabis is similar. You can be impaired, but a simple test is not going to, a sample test is not going to say if you're impaired. It has to be combined with some observed behavior that shows impairment or being under the influence. And that's what this bill provides for in the workplace.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a real quick rebuttal and then I'll move on. I disagree with you, Representative Winkler. If I think you're impaired and I get a UA and it comes back positive, and you're right, the level of THC will vary depending on how much you use. A light user would have a very light amount in this system and he could be impaired, and a chronic user could have a whole bunch and not be impaired. I understand that. But at the same time, if I feel you're impaired, I get a UA and you come back positive, you're going to say, I did it this weekend, I wasn't impaired at work. I have no comeback to that. So that's just a comeback. I know what you're saying. I'm gonna let my colleagues have some more time. Thank you.
Mr.
Chair, Representative Bliss, it's just—
I'm sorry, Majority Leader Winkler, I apologize.
I would just encourage members to actually read the bill on pages 144 and 145.
Representative Frederick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question that, something I think was already just addressed a little bit now. It talks about people on the job and in the workforce and manufacturing. And I know people in the manufacturing field that have used cannabis and have gotten glowing reviews, have been some of their top level performers. And so this whole idea that if we legalize cannabis, somehow it's gonna lead to everyone using cannabis in their workforce, I don't quite understand. I also don't understand why people are thinking that just because people are using this in the workforce that somehow it's going to have a negative effect on the work product, because I don't think that that is accurate. I think that is an individual case, a one-by-one scenario, and saying a blanket statement one way or the other is not accurate. I do have my question to the author was some of the testimony that was given today talked about labor rights. And there, we had a testifier that identified as a former member of AFSCME. I can say as a former member of AFSCME. AFSCME has officially endorsed this bill. They have come out in support of this bill publicly. And I would like to ask the questioner, at least give the author the opportunity to speak to whether or not this bill, since the question was raised, prevents union workers from striking at all, because that would be a pretty big deal to labor organizations if that was true.
Very clear.
Mr. Chair, Representative Frederick, a labor peace agreement essentially allows for a union and an employer to negotiate out the terms so that there will be no lockouts or strikes. It's a common practice, and it is only done pursuant to agreement with a labor organization.
Representative Frederick.
My last question was, what do you think that this bill in any way takes away from the state's ability to work on any other project out there, whether it's infrastructure, housing, or anything at all?
Majority Leader Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Frederick, I know that our members are busy working on housing and all of the other issues raised. We have a full plate, and I thank you for your time today.
Representative Byrd.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I believe Mr. Kalina mentioned in his testimony that Minnesota doesn't need more jobs. I would push back on that we absolutely need more jobs, specifically jobs in the community that the prohibition of cannabis targets, which are our Black and Brown communities. It's very easy as a white person to look at this issue and say we disagree with it. But my good friend Marcus Harkis testified on his personal experience as a Black man. I appreciate all the testifiers today, but I take exception to people testifying for communities they are not a part of. If you are not a veteran suffering from PTSD, you do not get to say whether or not this works for them. If you are not part of the BIPOC community, you don't get to say whether or not this issue affects them. I support this bill 100%. It is going to help people. It is going to create jobs. If it's well regulated and taxed, we get a revenue stream that we've never had before to support our other projects. And I thank the author for bringing this forward.
Majority Leader Winkler, any comments or we move on?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Detmer.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Winkler, can you give us any type of study findings that marijuana has been proven to reduce PTSD? Is there any medical findings that tell you that it will help with PTSD? I haven't found any.
Majority Leader Winkler.
Mr. Chair, Representative Detmer, I think the testimony of Ms. Schroeder mentioned the fact that the Minnesota Department of Health has found that the use of cannabis by veterans has allowed them to significantly reduce reliance on opioids. And so I did not say that cannabis has been determined in a peer-reviewed study to reduce PTSD, but the evidence from veterans, the testimony from veterans has been that it is a better alternative for them than many other forms of treatment. And I think it's important to consider that, especially since it doesn't have any of the negative consequences for most of them, unless other conditions are present that other prescription drugs would have. So I would refer you to the studies that Ms. Schroeder raised and the testimony including from Mr. Miller. It does help, according to the people who have it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So really, there is no scientific research out there now that will answer that it does help with PTSD. Now, I think most veterans know that several states in the United States have approved marijuana for medical or recreational use. Veterans should know that the federal law classifies marijuana as a Schedule I controlled substances. And it makes it illegal in the eyes of the federal government. So if we want to really change some things, it should be changed at the federal government. I think veterans participating in the state marijuana programs does not affect the ability, your eligibility for VA benefits and your services. VA providers can and do discuss marijuana with the veterans as part of the comprehensive care planning and adjusting treatment plans as necessary. Some things that I'm a veteran, I'm a 25-year veteran. I have twin sons that are West Point graduates. They're currently serving 4 or 5 deployments. Veterans will not be denied VA benefits because of marijuana use. veterans are encouraged to discuss their marijuana use with their VA providers. VA health care providers will record marijuana use in the VA medical records in order to have the information available in treatment planning. As with all clinical information, this is part of confidential medical record and protection under the patient privacy and confidential laws requires. VA clinicians may not recommend medical marijuana. Now, I support medical marijuana. That maybe as a state, we should be looking at maybe increasing the number of health issues that can be worked with medical marijuana and then work with the federal government to recognize that. VA clinicians may not complete paperwork required for veterans patients to participate in the state approved marijuana programs. And the VA pharmacies may not fill prescriptions of medical marijuana. VA will not pay for medical marijuana prescriptions from any source. So those are the facts that veterans should know. That's why I think what we should be concentrating on is the federal VA and how we can get the medical prescriptions out to our veterans. Again, I don't think our society needs another controlling substance out there to be legalized. And you only have to look at what has happened in some other states, the problems they've had, talk to law enforcement and so forth. Those are some things we need to be concerned about. But Representative Winkler, I really appreciate your research that you've done on this, but I think we have so many more things as a state that we should be dealing with than this right now. We have so many businesses that are underwater right now. We're dealing with the COVID-19 issue. We need to get kids back in school, all these different things that we really should be working on as a legislature. But thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Dittmer. And members, we have 4 minutes left and we will vote on this bill today. So please be brief on your comments. Representative Poston.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Winkler, first of all, I'm all for medical cannabis. I think it's great. I've heard a lot of very positive stories. But in my research, looking at states that have legalized recreational marijuana, a couple of things keep coming up. Number one, people think it's a tax bonanza for the state. And it turns out that it's really not a tax bonanza. In fact, the latest report from Colorado Christian University says in Colorado, for every dollar that comes in taxes, $4.50 go out on unintended consequences. The other thing that I hear over and over again is that people can't afford to buy the marijuana that's at the state dispensaries or the state licensed dispensaries. So the business is really being pushed right back at that guy on the street corner. In fact, it's been a bonanza for them because their prices have been able to increase. And as we've heard several testifiers here today, we don't know what's in that weed. You know, it scares us. So I just kind of like your thoughts on those couple of things, please.
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, thank you, Representative Poston. I think your second point is exactly why it makes sense to legalize. And this, Representative Dittmer made the same point, which is the VA can't prescribe it. The VA can't pay for it. And so if you're a veteran who can find relief from cannabis, your only choice is to buy it on the street or to pay the very high cost of our medical program. It's expensive and it's hard to get qualified for, and veterans particularly have a barrier to getting into it. Adult use cannabis, legalizing it in Minnesota, would permit veterans to get access to it through the commercial marketplace at a much cheaper cost than what is currently available through our medical program, and do so knowing the dose, knowing what's in it, knowing that it's regulated, knowing that it's safe. It is a much better alternative than the continued prohibition. As to the Colorado studies, there are a number of studies that have been put forward by organizations opposed to legalization. I would just say in Colorado that the support for legalization is higher now after almost 10 years of experience than it was when it first passed. People there like it. And if we were seeing major social problems that the data that you suggest have been happening, if that was actually happening, we wouldn't see support growing for legalized cannabis in Colorado. It works if it's done well. And what we're trying to do in this bill is do it the right way.
Representative Winkler, I have to tell you that I just read a report. I don't have it in front of me. But the report was they went back to the lawmakers that voted yes in Colorado and asked them how they would vote today. And there were a lot of them that turned from yes to no. So, you know, I don't know that the people in the state support it, like you said. I'll try to find that and send it to you because I thought that was pretty interesting that they went back and ask those lawmakers what their vote would be today.
Thank you, Representative Poston. Representative Raleigh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the author, if I could direct your attention to 23.4. It's the listing of the various license types. So 23.4 down to 23.17. Is it the author's intention in the bill that there will be a separation between growers, distributors, and retail, just like we have in alcohol regulation in Minnesota? So I'll ask the question succinctly. Would a grower also be able to be a distributor and a retailer? Mr. Chair.
Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Raleigh, only if you are a micro business can you be fully vertically integrated. The goal is to, it is not like the three-tier system for alcohol, in which nobody can be in either any other category, but you cannot fully vertically integrate by having licenses that stack for all three unless you are a very small business.
Representative Raleigh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then next, my question is on 87.15, and this is underneath the advertisement. Today, we heard a lot of testimony about the health benefits and the therapeutic benefits, and 87.15 says that there are limitations to all advertisements that contain unverified claims about the health or therapeutic benefits or effects of consuming cannabis or a cannabis product. And I'm wondering how we're going to be able to enforce that. And I'm looking at the tobacco advertising world that happened prior to the medical industry getting clamped down because tobacco to begin with was talked about as being therapeutic. We go back to self-serving here, Raleigh cigarettes and Ronald Reagan back in his Hollywood days would talk about the cool and therapeutic effects of smoking Raleigh lights. How are we going to think about that in 2021? And then what we're going to be able to do with that advertising in 2045, Mr. Chair.
Representative Raleigh, I appreciate the question. This is something that deals with the purview of the Commerce Committee. I'll allow Majority Leader Winkler to comment briefly on it.
I appreciate that, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, Representative Raleigh, that's why we have prohibitions in the bill on how advertisements can be made, including those targeting under the youth under the age of 21. We've learned the lesson in other states that we have to be very careful about advertising. We have to be careful about creating products that look like gummy bears or other things attractive to children. And while people can discuss and debate in a forum like this the health benefits of cannabis, we have to have truth in advertising on this for this substance, and that's why the bill is crafted the way it is.
Thank you, Majority Leader Winkler. We've got about 2 minutes left, members, and we will vote on this bill. Representative McDonald, briefly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Winkler, just a curious, I have heard from several of my friends who are veterans who take some medical marijuana, and it helps them immensely. But the same is true, we've heard it today, the dispensaries are far and few between, it's expensive. And oftentimes, I've heard of some of my friends that went down to the dispensary, they're closed. They took the drive all the way down from Annandale or Delano, they're closed. So why not fix what's broken now with our medical marijuana? And perhaps you'd even with that, you'd probably get a hearing in the Senate, which you don't, and you're not going to, on this bill. You'd actually really help our veterans by lowering the cost of medical marijuana and making the dispensaries a plethora throughout the Twin Cities of the Minnesota area, and really helping our veterans. So I'm curious as to why you didn't pursue that avenue instead of this particular bill. And then I have a real quick follow-up as well, Mr. Chair.
Majority Leader Winkler.
Mr. Chair, Representative McDonald, the bill does fix that in the medical program, including by adding the use of flower to the products that are available through the medical program. We have a separate bill on the medical program as well. But it's important to note, especially for veterans, that unless you have your own private insurance that's paying for it, and go see a doctor outside the VA system, you cannot get the prescription and you cannot get the payment that you need for cannabis. So, and in fact, so the point is that there are extra burdens for people who are relying on the VA system. And by creating an adult use marketplace, we would allow people to be able to safely access cannabis without at a much cheaper rate than what we could ever create through our existing cannabis or our medical only cannabis program.
Representative McDonald, very quickly, please.
Mr. Chair, well, that's fine, Representative Winkler, but unfortunately, it's not going to get it here in the Senate, so those good fixes for our veterans are not going to work. Lastly, Mr. Chair, Representative Winkler, you yourself and the DFL are banning flavored tobacco, but yet in your bill, you're allowing flavored cannabis. Isn't that an inconsistency and a contradictory?
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, Representative McDonald, we are considering how a flavor ban could work with cannabis and expect to address that in the Health Committee when we get there.
And lastly, Mr. Chair.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you for your indulgences. Representative Winkler, in the bill, it prohibits you from making candy-type looking children's gummy bears or whatever, but gummies do seem to be a very popular thing. What kind of a shape will they take if you're banning pretty much many, many other things that are capable of being made for gummy bears? What would they look like?
Mr. Chair, Representative McDonald, they could look like cubes.
Okay. Well, due to time, I will no longer ask any questions. So thank you, Representative Winkler and Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative McDonald. Representative Winkler, final thoughts today?
Mr. Chair, I just appreciate the time the committee has devoted to this. I think for all the concerns that members and members of the public and advocacy organizations can raise about cannabis in our communities and how it affects people, the bottom line is our current policies are a failure. They do not help with any of the concerns that people have raised. And a better approach is a regulated, safe marketplace where people know what they get, where we're providing accurate information, and members of the public can be assured that if they're using cannabis and getting properly informed, that they're doing so safely. I ask for your support today.
Thank you, Majority Leader Winkler. Ms. Doyle, will you please take the roll on the bill?
Chair Eklund.
Yes.
Eklund, aye. Vice Chair Zhang, excused. Representative Detmer.
No.
Detmer, no. Representative McDonald.
No, sorry.
McDonald, no. Representative Berg.
Aye.
Berg, aye. Representative Bliss.
No.
Bliss, no. Representative Edelson.
Aye.
Edelson, aye. Representative Frederick.
Aye.
Frederick, aye. Representative Greenman.
Aye.
Greenman, aye. Representative Nelson.
Aye.
Nelson, aye. Representative Poston.
No.
Poston, no. Representative Raleigh.
Raleigh's no.
Representative Raleigh, no. Representative Sundin.
I'm a yes.
Sundin, aye. And there are 7 ayes, 5 nays.
7 ayes and 5 nays. The motion's carried and the bill is on its way to its next committee. Members and staff, our next meeting is tomorrow, February 24th. We have 4 bills on the agenda. Any further comments or questions? Seeing none, we are adjourned.
I want to say thank you very much to everybody involved.